The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Morning glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt, back from Maine. I took a day off yesterday, the first summer day off in 2.5 years, and the first actual vacation day not linked to Christmas in a similar period of time. My thanks to Kurt Schlichter for sitting in for me yesterday, Monday, and I will look forward to the studio still standing, so that's a wonderful thing. I will look forward to having Kurt and Ed Morrissey and Mark Davis filling in for me come the end of July and the beginning of August as a real vacation beckons. But I had a great time in Maine. I've only been to Maine a couple of times in my life, and fetching Mrs. Hewitt's family lives up there. So off we went to Chabig Island and the Dolphin and downtown Portland, which, by the way, is remarkable. And to my WGAN listening audience on 560 and 98.5. You folks are wonderful. Everywhere I went, people listen to WGAN. The Hugh Hewitt Show is a thing in Maine, and I appreciate that greatly. Democrats and Republicans alike, liberals and conservatives, they all love a good conversation. So to the Mainers, your hospitality is wonderful. You are open for business. Spent most of yesterday visiting Seabag offices, fetching Mrs. Hewitt and I made a modest investment in that years ago, and now it's a thriving hallmark of Maine with just a remarkable team of managers and makers and creatives and social media people. And their operations director, Dylan, was a remarkable young man, took us all through their operations center. And Maine is booming. Maine is open. Maine has got almost a traffic jam. That's right, almost a traffic jam in Portland headed north. And I suspect, since the season really begins on July 4th. But you got to get used to boating. It's a little bit dangerous. The famous Patrick O'Brien novels always advise Stephen Maturin, the spy and doctor, he'll keep one hand for the boat. Well, I missed that rule. I did a full, however, in honor of the Olympics advancing upon us, I did a full somersault into a dinghy. 360-degree somersault into a dinghy from the dock of a boat that was moored. And emerged only bruised, but nothing broken, and elegantly executed, I might add. I'm sure I intended to do it. The poor teenager, Reed, if you're listening, I'm still fine. He turned white as a ghost and thought he'd killed me. But that's fine. It was, you know, rough seas. But I, not really, rough coordination. I had a wonderful time. And when I come back, I see just not good news. Not good news anywhere. The Delta variant of the COVID-19 surging across unvaccinated Africa now. And that was inevitable. It will surge across the world. It will come to the United States. It's already here. It will double every week or so among the unvaccinated. We have 180 million vaccinated in the United States, which means we've got 150 million who aren't vaccinated. And those 150 million are going to get the Delta variant. So get vaccinated, please. I no masks are anywhere in America except in airports and on airplanes, and respect that rule or you will be escorted off the airplane. And I want to thank everyone who's out there working every day. And if you're not infected and you run into another, if you're not vaccinated and you run into another person who's infected, you're going to get it. So don't roll those dice. There's no need to play that game. There's no return on it. You can only break even, which means that you have a mild case. But now I met some other people who had other than mild cases. And if you weren't listening last week to Leland Vitters from News Nation Now, Leland, 38 years old, terrific shape, foreign correspondent, now anchor for News Nation Now, 5 days in the hospital. I know people who died. I've known people who've been down for 2 or 3 weeks. I've known people who, you know, had a cold. But why roll the dice? Go get the vaccination. Sanofi in the Wall Street Journal announces today they're going big into mRNA, messenger RNA vaccines. This one has worked so well, so effectively, They're pouring $477 million into mRNA research, hoping to perfect vaccines among the entire coronavirus family. You know, we have long waited for the search for the common cold. Many people forget that because, of course, the common cold has not been around much in the last year and a half since we haven't been out and about transferring it from one to another as much as possible, and especially through the vectors that are preschools. And people forget how miserable you can be. More power to Sanofi. Biggest story of the day, Speaker Pelosi has introduced a joke. She's going to have a, quote, select committee made up of 13 members, five of whom will be Republicans that Leader McCarthy may be allowed to appoint. Now, I ask you, if it was really a threat to democracy, if it was really something that needed this big, big, significant investigation, wouldn't you make it 8-7 or 7-6? It's a 50-50 country. 8-5? Really? 8-5. She's so not confident of her own people, she cannot give herself a two-vote margin. And wouldn't you give the minority equal rights to hire their staff? And wouldn't you set up the rules that the committee would? I mean, if you were serious about it, like the 9/11 Commission, 50-50. But that was George W. Bush, not Nancy Pelosi. This is a political exercise intended for a political result. They're going to get hammered. The Democrats are going to get hammered because of terrible inflation and because of incoherent policy and wasting money. They're going to get hammered. Appeasement of Iran. They're going to get hammered in 2022. Redistricting is going to play into that as well as gerrymandering. Democrats will gerrymander when they can in like Illinois and Massachusetts, and they'll get screwed in other places like Florida and Texas. But along with the usual current of the first midterm of a new president, they're going to get hammered. So Leader McCarthy will become speaker. So this is a Hail Mary pass to try and come up with something. Some people say Leader McCarthy shouldn't appoint five. I think he should. Hope he appoints a very bold but smart lead Republican. I hope the bold but smart lead Republican hires a terrific senior counsel. I volunteer. I'm available. If they'll just start the hearings after 9 o'clock, I'll work all day. I'll do my show and come over, be there by 9:30. No one goes to work in Congress until 9:30 anyway. And be happy to do what Dick Leon, now a federal judge, but the senior counsel to Dick Cheney on Iran-Contra did, which is quietly make sure the real story is told. Do you remember anything about Iran-Contra other than Ollie North, if you remember that? No, because of Dick Cheney and Dick Leon. And so you have to do is methodical. Get to the truth. The truth is 800 people invaded the Capitol. A few dozen were bent on a coup, on an insurrection, on murder. They need to go to jail. They are going to jail. They need to be prosecuted. They are being prosecuted. Those who broke the law need to be punished. A great deal of distinction has to be made between those who peacefully demonstrated because they were upset about improvisation in the election of 2020. You don't have to believe in the big lie. I don't. There is no big lie. But I do think it's worth an investigation. Too bad it's not fair. Too bad it's a hack job by a hack speaker in defense. She's going to be the only speaker in history to have lost the majority twice. And she's desperate. And it shows in an 8-5 makeup. Some, you know, the Politico headline, political as always, says House GOP bristles. No, it doesn't. I've talked to staff already. They don't bristle. They just know it's a setup job. So what to do about a setup job? Follow the Cheney example. Dick Cheney, senior member, ranking member on the House Select Committee on Iran-Contra. Get ye a Dick Leon. I'm available. Find another one. Sit there patiently. Good lawyering will matter here. Good lawyering. Just got to ask the right question. How many people are being prosecuted, Director Wray? How many people, Attorney General Garland? What are the conviction rate? Are you not charging anyone? Have you found a far-reaching conspiracy? Any ties to the White House? It'll emerge that 800 people broke the law, a couple hundred, seriously. Some of them ringleaders, some of them intent on violence and mayhem, and we'll be done. Government antitrust lawsuits against Facebook thrown out by the federal judge. Big Facebook plant. More on that after the break. That's because they haven't violated the antitrust laws. Big tech is guilty of theft, fraud, invasion of privacy, but not antitrust. I'll explain more after the break. I'd like you to tell me if you agree with me about the House Select Committee, 1-800-520-1234. Connection to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Get ye to Maine. Go out to Shabig. Go out to the Dolphin. Great restaurant. Go to Sea Bags. Whatever you do, get up to Maine. I'm back in Virginia on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt. David Drucker joins me from the Washington Examiner. You see him all over TV. Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm great, Hugh. Good morning. Thank you.
I wanted your take on where the Select Committee vote stands and the appointment procedures for the five Republicans. It appeared from the reporting that Nancy Pelosi has not guaranteed Leader McCarthy the right to appoint the five.
Right. So it doesn't look like she's granted him outright authority. But I suspect that she'll end up allowing him to do so. I think what's interesting is that they are going to proceed with this. And then I think it's going to be a matter of how much authority and how much resources the committee is invested in. Sometimes these select committees can do quite a bit of work and reach conclusions and figure things out. Other times they cannot. I'm sort of less worried about the appointments. And both sides tend to, Republicans are going to get something. I think the question is whether it's a real fact-finding committee or whether it's just a committee for hearings where both sides end up arguing, you know, their points of view.
Now, David, my take on it is it's a fraud because it's 8-5, not 6-7. Secondly, it's a fraud because Pelosi is pretending to keep authority over it as opposed to granting it to the leader. Third, there is no provision for selection of senior counsel to the committee and subordinate staff and investigatory independent operations. I'm just thinking Iran-Contra when Dick Cheney was the ranking and Dick Leon was the senior counsel. It was effective to the day. It was the Ollie North hearings. It got done. This is a charade, and it's a very insecure speaker, by the way, who knows that she's going to lose the majority. So she's trying desperately to swing for the fences with a setup job. And it oozes setup job.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think the voters will judge the committee on its work product. So if, as you detail, this is how it's going to be set up, and if that's how the work product is going to unfold, then it's not going to be effective. And the broader issue is that the country is going to lose an opportunity to have an independent accounting of what happened on January 6th and why it happened. And I think
right. That
is the larger issue.
Now, if in fact McCarthy, the leader, determines to go ahead, my advice, given over the radio earlier, is you appoint no show ponies. You put up all the people who are most serious and experienced, and they do not ask questions. They defer to their lead counsel. They give their questions to lead counsel to determine minority counsel. Otherwise, it will dissolve into sound bites, some of which will embarrass the Republicans. And for whatever you do, don't put any of our more voluble members and none of the nutters on the committee. Do you agree, disagree?
Well, yeah. I mean, look, you know, half the problem with some of these committees, especially the select committees over the years, is you end up with preeners and you don't end up with workers. You need people who are serious investigators and people who know how to ask questions and aren't interested in television time. That is a very difficult thing to do. I mean, one of the reasons these committees have lost their punch is people half the time don't even ask questions. It's time for their question, and they just give a speech, and they try and play gotcha. This happens on both sides. It's been a problem. Look,
I remind people, Brett Kavanaugh is a confirmed justice of the Supreme Court today because the Senate Judiciary Committee hired outside counsel to ask questions of the witnesses. That's why he's a Supreme Court justice today.
Yeah, look, I mean, that was a really smart move on the Republicans' part at that time. What I was, you know, what I think here, you know, what I think is important here is that I think that without an independently created committee where both sides generally have authority, you know, the question is going to be, how does this thing function? And until we see more of it, it's hard to tell.
That's absolutely right. If you do not have the authority to hire your staff and to ask your own questions with a generous allocation of time that is fair and understood to be fair, It won't work, and it won't work if the leader appoints show ponies. Look, I wouldn't mind a Jim Jordan as the ranking member, but the other four have got to be very, because he's tenacious and understood by the Republicans to be no pushover. The other four ought to be quiet and calm, and then the lead counsel. I volunteered to be the lead counsel. They just have to start the hearings at 9:30, give me time to wrap up the show. And they just have to know what their job is, which is to ask and contain facts and shut down conspiracy theories. And I think repeat every day, 800 people, 80 of whom are organized, 8 of whom are going to jail for being the lead. I mean, I think that's the fact. And just to, you know, nip in the bud, QAnon stuff and stop the crazies on the left from going crazy. It's not hard to do if they get fair rules. Last word to you, David.
No. Well, look, I don't think this is a very difficult thing to do, but I think we have seen resistance. Look, Republicans were resistant to the legislation that would have created a formalized committee, so much so that Peter McCarthy had empowered Congressman Katko to go negotiate a deal. He actually was able to achieve the deal, and then he said, never mind. The Senate was more careful. They, Republicans in the Senate, whether you agree or disagree with them, never said, sure, we'll do it if you do it this way, well, and then pulled the rug out from under one of their members.
So I end up agreeing with the Senate.
Republicans have to deal with that. Democrats have to deal with the fact that if it's going to be a Pelosi committee, it's not going to have the confidence of voters across the board.
And it won't. And the Senate was right to reject it for the reason David Drucker just articulated. It would have ended up like the Pelosi kangaroo court. David Drucker, thank you, my friend. Be well, America. Stay back. Come back for hour number two of today's Hugh Hewitt Show. Morning, Glory America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt, back in Virginia. After 3 days in the great state of Maine, four actually, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, came back on last night from a wonderful Portland, Maine airport. Now, I have not flown into Portland, I don't know, in years and years and years. And it's a terrific, terrific airport. And I am bruised and unbowed. Had a great time. Went to the terrific Shebeag Island and the inn there. Took a boat ride over with my brother-in-law and sister-in-law and the fetching Mrs. Hewitt to the Dolphin. Had a great lunch. Spent the day in Portland yesterday looking through Seabags, their offices, their lead store. They're on Commercial Street. Going to their operations center because I'm the fetching Mrs. Hewitt and I made a modest investment in it years ago, and it's become a signature item in Maine. It's an amazing, talk about, I like, I'm a green investor. It's the greenest company I've ever seen. Nothing goes to waste. From recycled, everything is recycled sale. Remarkable company, but, and wonderful, wonderful young people. Portland is a happening place. I was unaware when I was in college a thousand years ago, and people would go up to L.L. Bean in Freeport, they'd pass through Maine, they keep driving, now they stop, and Maine is happening. But the unfortunate mishap involved a mooring of a 25-footer outside the Shebeag Island Inn, and I did a little bit of a header into the 360 degrees, actually kind of elegant. You couldn't have done this if you were an Olympian, into the dinghy. And one hand for the boat is the line that Dr. Matron always was told by the sailors in Patrick O'Brien's Master and Commander series. I forgot that. And so I gave them both feet and my backside. No lasting damage was done. It's hard to hurt yourself in a rubber boat. That is true. It's hard to hurt yourself in a rubber boat. But it was a elegantly, poor Reed, the 15-year-old driving the dinghy back and forth from the moorings to the inn, was white as a ghost. He thought he'd killed me. And it was rough seas and all that, but the other three people managed to get in. I just wanted to explore, what would they do with a man overboard? Not much, because we're like 100 feet from shore I could have swum in, but it was a interesting day. I wanted to tell you, though, Kurt Schlichter came in yesterday, did his normal, magnificent job. Only half of the studio is in embers, and Dwayne is missing. So I don't know what happened yesterday. Dwayne might be drinking it off. Let me go forward with the rest of the stories I haven't covered in the first. It's slow to start when you're back after a wonderful weekend in Maine. Maine, by the way, is open, open, open. Wow. Traffic for the first time. Now, there's always traffic on the Beltway, but that's a state of mind. That's just because nobody wants to drive in D.C. They're used to going 10 miles an hour. It's like Congress. And so it's D.C. is not a good indication of the rest of the country. But 95 and 295 north of Maine are. And on Friday, jammed up. On Monday, jammed up. Downtown Portland, great throngs of people. Restaurants are open. People are booming. Working wharves are working. I thought to myself, Maine did a very good job. Very good job. They are reopened and cooking. And if you are not yet vaccinated, I tell you this almost daily, please get vaccinated. Because what that means is that the Delta variant is going to be coming to a sidewalk cafe near you soon. And while mask mandates remain in place for airplanes and airports, and I wore them from Reagan to Portland and Portland to Reagan, the fact of the matter is that it doesn't make much sense for airports to have mask mandates when people mix like they do back in the United States. What makes sense is to get a vaccine, which are free and easily available at every drugstore or nearly every community via some drugstores in every community, or your doctor or a hospital. They're all over the place. And why roll the dice? Why roll the dice? No downside, lots of upside. For those who are 13 and older, go and get it. And I know all the stories about risk-reward ratio. They're just enormous. This is something that, like the polio vaccine, you don't not get it. Because for a small percentage of the significant percentage who will get it who are unvaccinated, you will have adverse consequences up to and including death. You don't do that to your family. You just don't. So don't put on a mask, but do go get a vaccine. As I started to tell you, the lead story is Nancy Pelosi's decision to have a select committee. It's a bogus committee, 8-5 in a 50-50 House. I mean, it is 50. It's the most closely divided House in my lifetime. It's 5 votes. Nancy can lose 5. So what'd she do? She doesn't do 7-6 or, 8-7. Democrat, Republican. She says 8-5, and she doesn't indicate that Leader McCarthy gets complete authority over his 5, and he doesn't. And she doesn't allocate a 45-55% Republican-Democrat split on resources and authority over their own minority council. In other words, she's doing everything differently than they did with the Iran-Contra when they had serious people running the House as opposed to hyper-partisans like Nancy Pelosi. The temptation is to walk away. You shouldn't walk away, but put in serious people. You have a conversation with each of them. The lead counsel is going to be in charge, and your questions will go through the lead counsel, but you're not going to interrupt flow of witnesses. They intend to get to the bottom of this. They intend not to allow showboating by the Democrats. They intend not to allow conspiracy theories by the Democrats. They intend not to allow Trump trashing by the Democrats. They're just going to get into the bottom of who organized the insurrection, who were the 800 people in the Capitol, how many of them were actually linked by conspiracy. The indictments would suggest less than 10%. How many of them were dangerous? What does that reflect about the country at large? I think the conspirators are few in number, but exceptionally dangerous. Some people had the intent to harm the speaker and the vice president. Those people need to go to jail for a long, long time. People who trespassed, who got caught up in the moment, need to get more than a slap on the wrist. An example must be made. No doubt in some people's mind they were engaged in a coup. It was fruitless. Trying to take a coup when the military is against you and the judiciary is against you and the elected officials are against you and the Republican Party is against you and the Democratic Party is against you and people love their democracy is an insane kind of fantasy. But we have Unabombers. People remember Jim Jones going off to Guyana and convincing hundreds of people to take the Kool-Aid. Well, a lot of people drank the proverbial Kool-Aid on January 6th. We need to find out why and where they came from and who they are. Did they have networks behind them? But Nancy Pelosi has set this up to fail. And the Republicans should be adamant about that. More importantly, Biden, the president of the United States, he is my president, he is your president, screwed up on their bait and switch. Normally, you don't jump the bait. It's like an April Fool's joke. Where you call it too quickly. I've done some very successful April Fool pranks on my kids, and there's a line, right? You gotta get them deep enough in to have evidence that they fell for it, like a recording or they contact somebody else. And there's some great pranks out there. But You don't let it go so far as to ever hurt anyone or embarrass them too badly. But you don't give it away too soon. If you laugh when you're setting it up, you know, that's a giveaway. Joe Biden laughed during the setup. You know, he had those five Republicans looking very earnest. People I like and admire a lot. Susan Collins, Mitt Romney, they're in the driveway. They're saying, good job. We're going to make this work. We need infrastructure, which we do. And then the president applauds and the Democrats on hand applaud Joe Manchin. They all go home. And 2 hours later, the president says, that's not really, that's half the deal. If the other half doesn't arrive at the same time, I'm vetoing it. What? No. This was supposed to go through the Senate, then the House, then to a conference committee. And once it was in law, it would be up to the reconciliation possibility was always out there. But armed with what he wanted, Manchin and Sinema were not likely to sign on to a reconciliation package that was crazy. Might have some adjustments in the tax code. No Republican's going to vote for a change of the tax code, but the Democrats won. They get reconciliation, two bites at the apple. But when President Biden blew the whistle and said they got to come together, that took away their leverage over Manchin and Sinema. It's all about Manchin and Sinema and the unnamed Democrats like Maggie Hassan, who's in the driveway with the president. They don't want to raise taxes in New Hampshire. She wants her job. The only way they get that is to combine the two, and that was not the deal. So the president said, I'm going to veto the bipartisan bill unless the partisan bill comes along, which is a way of putting Manchin and Sinema in a corner. The Republicans had not agreed to that. Now they're trying to walk it back. Too late. I say too late. Joe Biden undid the deal. He blundered, according to all the headlines. That's a nice word to put on it. And there's no one doing what he did. Tried to hold the Republicans and Manchin and Sinema hostage. They should say, we're done here and we do not trust you. Like President Obama, no trust. I'll be right back, America. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. That is not the normal intro music for Admiral James Stavridis, retired United States Navy, but I play it because I'm going to talk to him about Daniel Silva's new novel, The Cellist. Hello, Admiral. How are you?
Doing great, Hugh.
I bring up The Cellist by Daniel Silva because I think I finally read a book that you haven't read because I got the pre-publication copy. Am I right about that?
I can walk over here, pick it up, and show it to you.
I got it.
I've been asked to do a review of it for the Cipher Brief, which is a wonderful publication about the U.S. intelligence community. I just started it. I'm a huge Daniel Silva fan. He's amazing.
It's a terrific book, but doggone it. Now, I have finished it, so at least I'm ahead of you, but we don't want to give any spoilers away. I always talk to Daniel Silva on the 4th or 5th of July about his new book. But it led me to a number of questions, which I'm going to get to in a second, about Russia. But first, I have to ask you, you know the Patrick O'Brien Sea Stories.
I have a complete set of first editions here. Yes.
All right. That's rare. Now, how would you describe Stephen Matrin's ship skills?
Non-existent. He's the ultimate landlubber. The beauty of those novels is that it plays the captain, Jack Aubrey, who is the consummate sailor, but is completely lost ashore, against Dr. Stephen Matrin, who is a complete landlubber, can't tell port from starboard literally, but is a master on shore. He's a spy. He's a duelist. He's an expert shot. It's a wonderful pairing.
I bring it up because that will lead you, I think, into some sympathy for me. I was in Maine this weekend visiting family and had to make the boat to dinghy transfer and did a 360. One hand for the ship. I forgot the rule and did a complete 360. It's like getting into the admiral's or the captain's boat and just doing it. Now, I'm fine. It was a rubber dinghy. I'm just wondering, have you ever done that, or do midshipmen learn not to do that?
Midshipmen learn not to do that. That's the first thing they do, is put you in small boats and little sail craft called knockabouts. And you spend plenty of time on the water at Annapolis. I always say the three service academies physically are perfect representations of the culture of their service. West Point for boating, a fortress guarding the entrances from the river to New York. It looks like a prison. Annapolis, no prejudice here, Annapolis, surrounded by water on three sides, full of light and sun and the sea coming up that big, enormous Chesapeake Bay. And then finally, the Air Force Academy is just so open. It's like you're up in the sky. They're really three wonderful, iconic places, all three of them, of course.
I visited all three. My favorite is Annapolis for the reasons you just described. But I was struck by the difficulty landlubbers have when they encounter the sea. So, Admiral,
as long as you don't actually fall in the water.
I did not do that. I'm a little bruised. I did not do that. My brother-in-law, Marine Academy grad, gave me 2034. I'm going to be sending it to you for a signature. He loved it. I assume it's still selling like hotcakes. It's not in the picture. It's not in the frame.
Well, that's because there it is.
There it is.
On your wide shot. And it is. We're in our sixth printing.
Wow.
And well into six figures. And it continues to bubble along. I think I've told you we're doing a sequel to it, 2054, which will focus on cyber artificial intelligence and take the story of the surviving characters deep into the 21st century.
Okay, that takes me to my serious stuff. In The Cellist, Silva's new book, Russia's back at the center. A thinly disguised Putin is his antagonist with a lawn. You'll find out. I'm not going to give any spoilers away. What do you consider to be the relative strength, both militarily and cyber, of Russia, China, and Iran? Because those are the big three, right? The big three adversaries of the United States. How do you rank their military and their cyber capabilities relative to each other?
It goes Russia, China, just underneath Iran. You don't even see my hand in the picture. Russia, highly, highly capable with deep expertise in offensive cyber operation, using cyber effectively to take down kinetic systems. Example being when they dropped the Ukrainian electric grid, when they took out the Georgian command and control systems, when they invaded Georgia in 2008. China, almost as good offensive cyber. We really haven't seen them demonstrate their pure offensive capability the way we've seen Russia use it against cyber, against Georgia and against Ukraine. But China has its deepest expertise, as you might expect, in espionage-like activities, both industrial and against national targets. Very, very good at penetration, staying quiet in the circuits, extracting information. But quite capable offensively, and Russia is quite good at what I just described China doing. Iran is, I'd say, a second tier at best, but has high aspirations, has a technocratic government, has demonstrated some capability, has actually conducted an attack here in the United States against, of all things, a water facility in upstate New York. But Iran wants to join that club. The one that's kind of in the middle, Hugh, is Israel. To the novel's point, of course, one of the protagonists is the head of the Mossad. And Israel is quite good, not quite at the level of the big three, U.S., China, Russia, but put Israel next. Below that, I'd put Iran, North Korea, and some others.
Now, I confess to being a little bit surprised by your answer, Admiral. I thought you were going to put China atop the board simply because of massed force. They have so many people. Now, maybe in influence operations, I think they win in influence operations because we recognize the Russians a lot more than we recognize the PRC, CCP in the United States. But in terms of actual brute strength, you're still putting Putin's people on top.
I am in 2021, back to 2034. This is all about acceleration. And if you look at military capability, the same answer would pertain. Russia has a very, very capable, for example, nuclear submarines, utterly quiet, more of them, much more experienced deploying them. But China's rapidly ramping up in, frankly, in all aspects of maritime power. Same story in cyber. And where China has a pronounced lead over Russia is in artificial intelligence, facial recognition. So cyber is a very broad area, and you have to kind of dive into the individual areas. And you need to recall your point. China has much more mass to throw at the problem. They run, if you will, a kind of Olympic farm system, finding the very best and brightest, moving them into position, giving them resources. Russia does that too, but not as well. China is moving rapidly, and the real race, I'll finish with this, the real race is artificial intelligence and quantum.
Well, Admiral, you've met most everyone. Have you met President Putin?
I have, once, glancingly, handshake. Enough to kind of a 3-minute snapshot. I was introduced to him by the Minister of Defense of Russia when I was Supreme Allied Commander. And it was a look in the eyes. And as everyone says, it's a pretty cold stare.
Well, Dick Cheney said, when I look in his eyes, I saw a KGB colonel. What's your impression of him? Because he's at the center of the cellist and he's at the center of the world, right? And the cellist describes him as vulgar, intimidating, likes to make people nervous, enjoys the discomfort of others. I'm not sure that 3 minutes would give you a chance, and I'm not sure he would do that to the Allied Supreme Commander of NATO. But what was your impression of those couple of minutes?
Entirely accurate. Cold, supercilious is a word that comes to mind. Certain of his own superiority, which I often find is a marker of insecurity in people. He is... by all accounts, here I broach into widely reported characteristics. He is someone who believes himself to be the Tsar of Russia and has that model in mind. And I think he will continue to see himself that way and quite effectively control the country until the day he dies. In fact, in the 2034, we see Vladimir Putin as an octogenarian, still very much in control of the country. 2054, the sequel, you'll have to wait and see if artificial intelligence permits a life extension. Who knows?
We're going to have to wait and see whether or not he's also designated a successor, which he hasn't done yet. So who is the more formidable adversary, President Xi or President Putin?
President Xi by a country mile. And the reasons are two. One is Xi has just enormous resources at his command, obviously. An economy that's on the move, a population that is not declining to the degree that Russia's is. Although China has some demographic challenges, he has a much better geographic position. China is a much better basket of resources. And secondly, Xi is a strategist. Vladimir Putin is an excellent tactician. He can figure out how to undermine the United States in Syria, how to manipulate our elections, how to jump into Ukraine, how to snatch Crimea. These are tactical things. President Xi is playing the long game the way China always does. President Xi has told us he wants to dominate the world scene. China wants to dominate the world scene by mid-century. He's got a very clever strategy and Belt and Road Initiative. Xi thinks strategically. Putin thinks tactically. Advantage Xi.
Last question, Admiral Stavridis. If you were to go back to 2014 and you're advising President Obama at that point and Crimea is being invaded and Ukraine is being invaded by little green men, was there any alternative to what was in effect a throw up our hands, we can't do anything about it strategy?
Unfortunately, there was not, because it happened so swiftly and it was such a surprise. Recall, this was a almost instantaneous operation that came almost from nowhere. Now, you always get some level of markers, but this is 2014, and the little green men, as you call them correctly, these are unmarked Spetsnaz special forces, highly capable. They sweep across eastern Ukraine. They're instantly into Crimea. And what you have to remember, Hugh, is Crimea is the center of the Russian ethnic population within Ukraine. There's huge sentiment there that is pro-Russian, as there is in much of eastern, particularly southeastern Ukraine. So he was sweeping into an area where there was a lot of popular support on the ground. It was a well-planned operation. You know, see paragraph one, Putin, excellent tactician. He used the element of surprise, hybrid warfare very effectively. We were caught on our back foot from intelligence perspective. Where the administration could have done more is more lethal aid, rapidly send signals, get the focus on globally on Putin. We did some of that, probably not as effectively as we should have done.
Admiral, always a pleasure to talk to you. 2034 in Book of Six printing. That's amazing. That's like Hunt for Red October territory, Admiral. Thank you very much. I will talk to you again next week. Don't go anywhere, America, except to get your copy of 2034 or your copy of Silva's The Cellist. Pre-order it. And, of course, if you're going to fall into a boat or fall anywhere this summer, get relieffactor.com. I'm fine because I bounce back. I think it adds resiliency to people. Relieffactor.com. I, Karen Kirkham, and Resveratrol Omega took it in the first hour. I remind you about it two more times during the course of the day. Please make sure that you give it a shot. Please make sure you are always thinking about your best health. And that means relieffactor.com. Join the tens of thousands of people who take it every single day. Coming up, Josh Crosshour, Hotline Josh. We talk about Nancy Pelosi's sham committee when we come back here on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined by Josh Crosshour. Hotline Josh to you on Twitter, working for the National Journal, covering, no doubt, Nancy Pelosi's sham select committee. Josh, I will ask you from your vast trove of memory to compare the select committee on Iran-Contra and its climate and operation with what you expect to happen with the so-called select committee on the insurrection.
Well, Iran-Contra was a little bit before my time. I remember the history. I remember the debates, from reading about it. But, this is a consequence, I think, of the bipartisan committee attempt not going through Congress, McConnell opposing it, McCarthy opposing it, and now it's going to be a much more partisan affair. And then we'll see. I mean, that may taint the outcome. It may taint the results. But Pelosi was determined to go through with this, to have some degree of accountability from her point of view in terms of what happened on January 6th.
Let's not let her off the hook, Josh, because it's a 50-50 Congress. Actually, 50.005 to 49.0095, right? Something like that. Instead, she got an 8-5 committee, Democrat-Republican, and very limited powers from the minority. This is in contrast to Iran-Contra, where Dick Cheney was the ranking minority leader with full authority over his legal staff, including future federal judge Dick Leon as his senior counsel. Here, Nancy Pelosi hasn't even guaranteed the leader, McCarthy, the right to name the five. So while the Senate did not agree to set up, and I'm glad they didn't, a so-called special commission, the select committee precedents are not partisan. She has made this partisan. Therefore, it lacked credibility out of the gate. And I just think if anyone goes back to study Iran-Contra, and you are too young to remember it, but I remember it quite well, it's written up in Peggy Noonan's What I Saw at the Revolution. It worked. It worked well because Whip Cheney and Counsel Leon were in charge, but they also had the confidence of both sides of the House in the undertaking and the rules of the committee.
Yeah, Hugh, I agree with you that this whole exercise is partisan. I think it's partisan on both sides, and sadly, there has been no real, I think the commission that there was bipartisan support, a couple dozen House Republicans agreed with Democrats to have a commission process to examine what happened on January 6th. I think it would have been a much more fair and balanced way of going about this, but Republican leadership, frankly, worried about the politics in a midterm election, did not want that to go through. So, I agree with you that this is partisan, but I don't know how you escape and disconnect the partisanship from this.
That's it, Josh. Wait a minute. That's easy. You make it 6-7 Republican-Democrat, and you give 45% of the budget to the Republicans to spend and 55% of the budget to the Democrats to spend, and you give them nearly equal time with witnesses, and you give them each subpoena power. That's how you make it bipartisan, even if it's one House. That's how you do it. It's very easy for Pelosi to have done that. She chose not to do it.
Right. As a response, though, to not having a commission that was intended to be bipartisan, nonpartisan, however you want to describe it. I mean, I think that was sort of the ball. Like, I mean, that was sort of the original intent, and then it became this partisan football.
Josh, I want to disagree. I want to disagree because the Senate is an independent body. They did not want to do it. It's 50-50, and they thought the rules of the road were not fair, so they turned it down. They thought the timing was not fair, so they turned it down. So the ball goes back to Pelosi, and she can choose again, partisan, nonpartisan. she again chooses hyper-partisan, and she doesn't have to do so. So there isn't any fault on the House or the Senate. It's all Pelosi's decision to do what she always does, which is to hyper-politicize everything.
Yeah, I mean, I, as a political analyst, I look at, like, which party is where do you have bipartisan support? And there were Republicans, quite a few in the House and some in the Senate as well, that did support the commission. It did agree with where Democrats originally were on looking back at January 6th and having a process to hold some folks accountable. And so, I mean, look, I mean, I've been talking and writing about the infrastructure debate, and it's the Democrats who are divided. And that's where the politics are right in that issue. The fact that you had Republicans, quite a few of them, who wanted to go about doing the commission, McConnell, McCarthy, for I understand the political considerations there, but they ultimately decided not to go through with it. So I think everything's been partisan. I don't see any one side holding a
Well, we disagree about that. I think Nancy Pelosi set up the original commission to end about the time that people vote in 2022 instead of giving it a 6-month timeline. I think the budgeting and the authorities were not equal, the subpoena authority, et cetera. But in any event, she didn't have to politicize this. Quickly, Josh, the Republicans have to make a choice. I hear Jim Jordan is going to be their ranking member of the five. I would make sure the others were not other than hyper-competent senior members of the Congress. And I would make sure that everyone agreed to let the senior counsel to the committee ask the questions. I volunteered for that job. Is there any indication what the Republicans will do with their five seats? Is it going to be Jim Jordan as the ranking minority member?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very, very strong possibility. I think given that this is going on a more partisan route, expect to see some of the feistier House Republicans. I think they want some competence, but also folks who are going to get in the trenches with Democrats. I agree with you that this is not, I don't think this is going to be a lot more heat than light, whatever comes of this process. And I think McCarthy is certainly going to play the partisan card in terms of fighting back.
I hope they just let the lawyers ask the question. The best way to act is like Dick Cheney and Dick Leon. Josh Kroshauer, follow him at Hotline Josh. Follow me to hour number 3. Senator Tim Scott among my guests, America. Stay tuned. I want to remind you that our sponsor is AndrewandTodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to AndrewandTodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway again after a day spent up in Maine, closing out a weekend, joined by Congressman Mike Rogers of Alabama's 3rd Congressional District. He's the ranking minority member on the House Armed Services Committee. Very important. Good morning, Congressman. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
You know, you got a couple of bad guys on that committee, Gallagher and Walsh. How do you keep them in line?
Yeah, they are up to mischief, as a general rule.
All the time. And they're talking football. I just don't know what you do. Look, Chairman, former Chairman, future Chairman, I've got a lot to ask you, but let's start with this reading list controversy. The Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, the CNO, there are all sorts of reading list controversies. Why don't you put out a reading list? And my suggestions would be Chaos Under Heaven by Josh Rogan, Doom by Niall Ferguson, 2034 by Admiral Stavridis, and The Cellist by Daniel Silva. I mean, you got to conclude some novels for your Pennsylvania members because they can't read serious books. But what about that? Why don't you put out a reading list?
That's a good idea. I guess I need to be working on that.
Well, those four. Chaos Under Heaven, Josh Rogan, and Doom. Those are hard to read, but a wonderful read. Serious books. And then 2034 and The Cellist are great novels. They'll teach your Pittsburgh people especially. They're slow, Mr. Chair. They're slow. Tell me something, Congressman Rogers. What do you think about the so-called select committee that Nancy Pelosi is suggesting?
It's just another partisan endeavor. She's trying her best to drag this out as long as she can to keep attention on the riot of January 6th. It's completely unnecessary. We knew after the commission by General Honoré what the problems were. And then the Senate commission that just released their report a couple of weeks ago was very thorough, very bipartisan. There's nothing else to learn. It's just she wants to continue this dynamic of focus on the right because she wants to justify continuing proxy voting, which is something that she set up, as you know, last year. And if she ever lets it go, then all of a sudden her members will actually have to show up to vote. And with her narrow margins in the House, she can't afford to worry about that. So she wants to keep this proxy voting going.
That's interesting.
So she's going to keep talking about the select committee, the threat to members, and the pandemic, and not try to keep attention away from what a lousy job they're doing governing this country.
Now, you see, that's why we talk to people. I hadn't thought of that aspect, Congressman. I am opposed to it as an 8-5 partisan clown car kangaroo court. If it was 7-6, 55% of the budget and the staff to the Dems, 45% to the Republicans with complete authority in the chair to subpoena and in the minority leader to subpoena, I'd be less concerned. But that ain't what it is. It's 8-5 with no authority in the Republican members. I know the leader pretty well. I've known Kevin forever. He'd do a good job selecting, and you get a counsel like me as your senior counsel. You could do Dick Cheney and Dick Leon, a replay of a wrong country. It'd be a serious endeavor. This is a show trial. This is not a serious effort.
That's exactly my point. There's nothing else to learn. She wants to keep talking about this because it takes tension away from, you know, this ridiculous, reckless spending they're doing. And this legislation, this socialist legislation, they're shooting out of the House on a daily basis that fortunately is going nowhere in the Senate. It's all shuck and jive, and that's what they're good at.
All right. Now, let's talk, Congressman, about the, quote, bipartisan, close quote, infrastructure deal. I am not opposed to what the 10 members agreed to. I am very opposed to not passing that before reconciliation. If they begin reconciliation, if they pass a budget bill in either the House or the Senate, that thing should be dead. Because the whole idea was to pass that, and then it would be on Manchin, Sinema, Maggie Hassan, and others to decide how to check the Democrats in the Senate. Joe Biden double-crossed everybody. And, I mean, does anyone fooled by what he did?
Of course not. And there's nothing going to pass over here. They're talking delusionally about passing this stuff. That bipartisan deal was never going to pass the House. And Pelosi already said she wasn't even going to let it come up if they didn't have the reconciliation bill first. So everything between the leadership of the House and Senate is just a dogfall, not going to happen, and people need to manage their expectations.
Now, you just used an Alabama word on me, dogfall. That might be what is a dog? That might be a Pittsburgh word. What is a dog fall, Congressman?
That means it's going to come to a draw.
Okay. So let me ask you about if it was just the bipartisan infrastructure bill, would it fail for lack of the left in the House Democratic Caucus, or would it fail because of the Freedom Caucus? Which way would it go there?
Take your pick. Either one would bring it down.
Okay. So it's just the bipartisan bill's not getting through, period.
Correct.
I'm surprised by that.
There's never been a chance of the reconciliation bill, I think, being enough for the left. But I could be wrong.
No, I know the reconciliation bill would fail. It won't get through the Senate, but as it's drafted by Bernie Sanders. But what about the standalone infrastructure bill? Would there be enough center-right Republicans and enough liberal, old-school Democrats to just go for the pork and the infrastructure?
I doubt it.
Really? That's interesting. Enough of the lefty. The squad plus the Freedom Caucus would kill it?
When you look at the narrow margins over here, yeah. I mean, look, the Democrats have a 3 or 4 vote margins, all they've got. And it's just hard to thread the needle in this place these days. I just find it, I've learned to lower my expectations on what can be accomplished. You know, you look back at when we were in the majority and we had 245 members, we could almost never get 218 because we couldn't get the Freedom Caucus on board. So when you come down to a situation where the margins are much narrower, you have to really lower your expectations.
You have to find genuine bipartisanship. The only way to do it.
It does not exist in this place right now. Not with the leadership that we've got. You know, you've got Nancy Pelosi, who knows this is her last hurrah. She is about to leave, and plus she's being pushed hard by the left. And then on the Senate side, you know, Schumer is terrified of AOC challenging him in a primary, so he's so far off to the left. I guarantee you it's about a third of the Democrat members of the Senate are hiding behind Sinema and Joe Manchin, hoping they continue to fight because it could drag them down, too. I just think that that there's no way you're going to get bipartisanship with that kind of dynamic.
All right, let's talk a little bit about your committee, because I should have added a fifth book to your reading list as ranking minority member of House Armed Services Committee, which is To Provide and Maintain, a book by Jerry Hendricks, a retired Navy captain, on the future of the fleet. I cannot believe this country has spent $6 trillion and you didn't get one ship out of it. I, the Chinese are building 20 ships a year. We're building seven, maybe six, and they're not all combatants. What is going on, Congressman Rogers? That is, we're giving up.
We are, and that's just unacceptable. You know, you look at this year's budget, we're going to be, it only asks for eight new Battle Force ships. Two of those are tugboats.
Right.
And it's decommissioning 15, and seven of those are cruisers. You know, as I asked Admiral Gilday when they testified before us, is this budget going to shrink the Navy? He said, yes, sir. And, you know, they've made it clear that we've got to try to keep pace with China, which is dramatically growing their Navy, with not just number of ships, but capability. That's the thing that we've always hidden behind in the past is, well, you know, they got a bigger Navy, but our ships are more capable. They're quickly getting capable, too. And this is not an acceptable budget, and it's a completely unacceptable trend line that we've got across the services. The fact is, you know, the chairman makes the point, well, you know, we're spending a lot of money. Yeah, we are. But the fact is China's spending more, and that's the pacing threat that we've got to keep up with. And it's not whether we like spending the money or not. We just have to do what we have to do to remain a superpower and in front of China.
You know, Congressman, I am reminded of Dreadnought by Robert Massey. Maybe that'll be sixth book. And the Steelers fans will never get through it. It doesn't have any pictures, and it's 200 pages plus. But if they if they have Dreadnought, you know, I'm just being honest with you. Wait till I get to the Alabama gangsters down there and talk about their how they always screw the Big Ten when we come and play South. But I'll come to that in a bit. If they read Dreadnought, this is a replay of the late 1800s, early 1900s, when Germany challenged Great Britain. And Great Britain didn't keep up because of budget, and they had a war. And right now, China is just building more combatants than we are. And we need 450, according to Jim Banks. I'd settle for 355, but I think we're headed to 275. Am I wrong?
No, you're exactly right. You're exactly right. And that's the thing that we have to keep telling people to break through, that this is unacceptable. You know, one of the things that we heard from Secretary Austin and Chairman Milley when they testified before us is this is acceptable budget for 1 year. And but then both of them said, but over the next decade, we have to really step it up. And my point was, we can't afford to postpone this for 1 year, because I guarantee you they'll come back next year and do it again, which is basically a little bit less than a level budget. This is effectively this year's $4 billion cut. But it's unacceptable that we can't keep deferring what we need to do, knowing that what we need to do takes 10 or 12 years.
Well, let me talk to you a little bit, Congressman, about the Columbia-class leg of the triad, the nuclear submarine. We know how many we need. We know roughly what they're going to cost. You could forward fund. I mean, we spent $6 trillion. They could have forward funded the ballistic missile fleet, which is the key to the defense of the West, and they didn't get a dime out of it.
I know, and they don't seem to think that we care or that it matters. But, you know, that's Biden. You know, the fact is, you know, my pastor's always said for years that if you want to know what somebody's priorities are, you look at their calendar and see where they've been spending their time, and then look at their checkbook registry and see where they've been spending their money. Well, if you look at this year's budget proposal by the president, he cuts funding in only two areas of discretionary spending: Homeland Security and defense. Everything else he increased by an average of over 16%. He does not care about national security. In fact, what he did, Homeland Security, was almost to decimate ICE. It's not a priority, and it's the left pushed him to go further and cut defense even more. So we're going to fight back. You know, I go back to the narrow margins they've got. The fact is they can't pass anything when it comes to defense without us, whether it's defense spending or defense authorization. So we're going to get a better deal than what's on the table, but it's going to be a long and difficult process.
Well, hang in there. Come back often when your chairman come back. Tell me, Congressman, one last question. Is your pastor an Alabama fan, an Auburn fan, or an Ohio State fan?
Well, unfortunately, he's an Auburn fan, but he's a good guy anyway.
Well, he's not of the one true church for the Buckeyes, but he's closer than you are. So we're going to leave it at that. Thank you, Congressman. Good to talk to you. Come back. Chairman Mike Rogers, he's soon to be Chairman Mike Rogers. He's not yet the chairman. He's the ranking minority member on House Armed Services. And I hope he puts out a reading list. We've been talking about the CNO's reading list, the chief of staff, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs reading list. He should have Chaos Under Heaven, Doom, 2034, The Chalice, and Dreadnought. That's his five. I'll put that on Twitter. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Joined now by Senator Tim Scott of the Senate of the United States from South Carolina. Good morning, Senator. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Hugh, how are you?
I'm great. I got a couple of quick questions for you. Do you feel double-crossed by President Biden threatening to veto the infrastructure compromise unless he got a reconciliation bill at the same time?
Well, there's no doubt about it. Anytime you think you have a deal, even though I may have voted against that deal, to have something added to that is just irresponsible, disrespectful, and definitely craters the deal from my perspective.
The 10 members who they were counting on, I know Lindsey Graham has said it cratered the deal. Have the other ones, like Senator Collins, Senator Romney, for I have enormous respect for those two, have they talked to you yet about absolutely being bewildered and done with a sham process?
We have not had a conversation at all, so I won't say what their positions are, but my position is pretty clear that you cannot have some caveat that spends $3 trillion, eliminates the right to work laws in my state and 26 other states, and call that the precursor or the prerequisite for getting actual infrastructure taken care of. It's wrong. It's bad, and it's out of step with reality.
Now, my understanding is the original deal was we will pass infrastructure in the Senate, see if it passes the House. If it does, go to a conference committee, agree, negotiate, send it to the president. And when that's all done, then you can try reconciliation, but not before. Was that your understanding?
Well, my understanding is that you can't trust what the president says on infrastructure. That's my simple answer. And when that is the case, nothing else quite matters. The bottom line is a simple one, though, Hugh. If you're looking at a path to reconciliation, that's something that Joe Manchin and Senator Sinema will have to stop from happening. What we can do is focus on those priorities that the American people have around infrastructure. Any deal that requires us to do bad policy or make bad policy decisions to get to the good ones is bad overall.
Well, I know that, but what's happened in the media, the narrative, the media cover for the Democrat double cross, is they're out there saying, oh, the Republicans always knew there would be a reconciliation. And I keep saying, no, no, no. The Republicans knew that they were going to pass infrastructure. Then you would try to pass reconciliation, but they knew it wouldn't pass. They were never joined at the hip. Am I right?
You are 100% right. It's without any question. This is how we see these socialist ideas start being socialized in their public forum. It is wrong. It is not consistent with any deal that was ever on the table, as far as I know. And we had this conversation just last Thursday amongst the Republican senators. This was a non-starter for everyone that was in the room.
And I believe that members of your caucus, who I talked to, were counting on Manchin, Sinema, Hassan, and a few others to sink the reconciliation deal, and that this was a way to jump over that opposition by linking the two. Am I right again?
Don't know the answer to that question, to be honest with you, Hugh. I would say that there's no doubt that there's been a bipartisan coalition interested in reducing the infrastructure package. The question is, can the Democrats stand the heat in the kitchen? If they can, then they stand against their party. If they don't, they succumb to the pressure. I don't want reconciliation to be used on a $2 trillion mammoth package that has less to do with traditional infrastructure and more to do with a utopian society that can't exist because you can't perfect man and you can't expect people in Washington to spend your money better than you would.
I also expect reconciliation will do away with much of the 2017 tax bill, including stepped up basis, which has never been in doubt. I mean, it's a radical proposal. Am I right about that?
100% right about that. There's no doubt that when you look at the tax and spend packages that they put forward, we know how they're going to spend money. Well, actually, We know the words they use, even though they're no longer found in the dictionary as relates to the definition. But on the taxing side, we know that taking the capital gains tax from 23.8% to 43.8% will not only slow our economy, but it will actually remove the first few rungs on the economic ladder for those who are most disenfranchised and stuck outside of the middle class. We know that taking our corporate tax rate from 21% to 28% puts us in the least competitive position that we've been in since we reduced the corporate tax rate from 35%. We know that eliminating the 20% pass-through benefit for our smaller businesses will only make them have harder decisions on hiring employees or investing in new capital. If you don't invest in new capital, you're actually taking away jobs in the future. So this approach to taxation is the elimination of jobs for the middle class and for those folks who are trying to enter into the workforce. It is a contrast to what we saw during the Trump years. The Trump economy, brought to you by a strong majority of Republicans, brought the lowest unemployment rates, the fastest increase in wages at the bottom 20%. We saw economic growth for African Americans, Hispanics, Asians, women, majority men. Every demographic or cohort you can think of prospered under the Trump economy, and we reset education in a constructive and positive way.
Well, Senator, I would love to get another 100% agreement out of you. We're running out of time, but I know that you would agree with me that in the preseason rating rankings, Ohio State should be above Clemson. Not enough time to get your response, and then I'm just going to anticipate your agreement. Senator, thank you, and come back again soon. America, come back tomorrow. I'll be back right here talking to you from inside the Beltway on the next Hugh Hewitt Show.